Thank you for downloading the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. We are covering the television series Twin Peaks. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. Spoiler warning, we are not a spoiler-free podcast. We spoil. So if you'd like to listen to us, we would love to have you listen, but please go back and watch all of Twin Peaks first, then come back and listen to us so we don't ruin anything for you, because we would hate to do that, but we'd love to have you listen. You have been warned.
If you would like to support this podcast, the best way to support us is to head over to iTunes and write us a review. Can't bring yourself to do that because you think that's embarrassing, you can click on some stars. It's not hard. Just head over there even while you're listening to us right now and just...
It's such a small thing to do, but it makes such a difference in our lives.
Yes, it helps attract people to us.
We also have an Amazon link. Just go to our webpage at noship.net, click on the Amazon link, and it takes you to the Amazon homepage. From there, you can do your shopping just like usual. And it doesn't cost you a penny extra, but it gives us a little bit of a kickback. So
pennies that we can start to stack and eventually make a giant tower of pennies,
because that's a stated goal of Sparkwood 21 on the No Ship Network. Yes. Is to have a couple of stacks, a tower. Yes. Stacks of pennies.
Yes. And Steve, do you have a PSA?
I do. For the remainder of the podcast, please, for your safety and ours, stay on the bike. We paid for those sound effects, by the way.
Yeah.
With kickbacks we got from Amazon. All right. Today we have something a little bit different. I'm going to do the recap. So don't turn it off. Don't turn it off. It's okay. I can do a recap. You'll see. I promise.
They've heard you do a recap before.
Not all of them. I've only done, what, one or two? Is this the second one or the third one?
I want to say this is the second.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I did one
other
one.
Didn't you do a recap for something else? Did you do one for Penny Dreadful?
No. Okay. I don't think you would have let me. But, well, just because, you know.
Well, anyway.
Anyway, okay. All right, you're getting a Steve recap, so just deal with it. All right, Twin Peaks Season 2, Episode 15, entitled Slaves and Masters, directed by Diane Keaton, written by Harley Payton and Robert Engels, and produced by Harley Payton. Before we get started with the recap, do you have any thoughts about this episode?
So we're trying not to be negative. So I was just, you know, it's interesting to think about her approach and Diane Keaton and why she did what she did. So I guess we could talk about those as we come across these scenes.
Watching it for a second or third time, or however many times you've seen it now, did going into it knowing that Diane Keaton directed it and knowing that she kind of had an artsy approach, did it color your vision or your view of while you were watching it?
Well, I don't think I realized it the first time I watched it. I don't even think I had seen Annie Hall or anything at that time.
Yeah. I know I didn't realize it at all. I mean, I had to be told that, you know, this, because I'm not a person who really pays attention to who's directing an episode. I'll look at who's writing it, but I'm not so much of the directorial
thing. I think that's changed. I think
it has changed, but, you know, definitely like 15 years ago, I had no conception of that kind of stuff.
I still wasn't, when we watched it together 15 years ago, I mean, I was really young and still kind of in that mindset where everybody who was producing something, I just thought was awesome. Like I didn't have a critical approach, at that time. And, you know, and I realize I don't have the skills needed to make a television episode. So sometimes I feel like a fraud when I do criticize, but, I am doing a podcast, so I need to, you know, bring something to the table, right?
Yeah, but everybody judges, and everybody's a critic, and it's just – I understand where you're coming from, though. You know what I mean? But if you go to a restaurant and, you know, these people are putting out this type of food that you don't know how to cook, but you get the meal, you get the plate in front of you, and it tastes like crap, it still tastes like crap.
Yeah,
even though
yeah.
you might not be able to go back there and do what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, per se.
The thing is I'm much more critical now, whether I'm doing a podcast or not, which you know how critical I am.
Yes, yes.
And which is in some ways sad, but most as far as like how I like to, if I like to air it out publicly, I usually feel a little weird about doing that. But, you know, but we are podcasting on this, so that's our prerogative, right? And yeah. So, you know, and also coming from our point of view, we're watching this as people who consume television. We haven't gone to film school at NYU.
Yeah,
we don't read books about how to produce television or movies or anything like that. I mean, I've read some things, but not, not exclusively.
Nothing from an academic standpoint.
Yeah.
It's more of just like an informative standpoint.
Yeah.
So when we criticize a particular director, it's not because we're going, they should have used this lens and had this shot and then panned over here to do this and using all this technical jargon that we don't know.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like saying, okay, as the person sitting on the other side of the screen watching this, I felt less good about this than I did when somebody else did it.
Yeah, it's just it's more I scrutinize it in a way where I'm just curious as to the process as to why, like, for instance, when you get into the opening, we're looking at these chess pieces, and then there's a superimposition of the queen over the queen. Why?
Sometimes a good director can let you unravel that reason, and it's kind of like a quest to do that, and you watch the episode and then you finally figure it out and it's like a little light bulb goes off over your head. And then other times you come up empty-handed. And I think there was a few times in this episode, my biggest criticism of it would be that some of those things that were done director-wise, I guess is the best way to put that, made me come up empty-handed as far as, what import did this have? Was there any kind of insight that could have been gleaned from the scene being shot the way it was? And I just keep coming up with, no, not really.
Well, I think the only thing I could come up with that by that particular thing I brought up is the bookend. You've got the queen, and then you've got at the very end Wyndham Earle asking who would be his queen, and it's either Donna Shelley or
There you go.
Audrey.
Perhaps.
But the way it's done, it's kind of you have a superimposition of an image of the queen over the queen. I don't know. I think
Then it becomes a little heavy-handed, maybe.
I don't know. I don't even think it's heavy-handed. I just it's just way off. I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's
All right.
just maybe if there was three queens, superimposed over it, or if it had more. Sometimes you want things to be a little bit more on the nose than not.
You don't want to have to search too hard for it and have to be too clever for it, especially if it's not
Well,
necessarily there.
if you have to search, which is fun when you're trying to connect the dots, and then when you do connect the dots, they fit.
Yeah. Or they make a picture, that you can go, okay, that's why there was dots in the
Yeah.
first place. Well, I won't go too far into my thoughts on it because I'll start with a recap, but I'd just like to say that, in the spirit of keeping with trying to find the silver lining in the gray that is this era of season two, my high points were Albert in this episode, his scenes I really liked. I thought there was the good ones between him and Cooper. The Ed and Norma stuff I thought was pretty cool. And it just, I don't know, it just struck me as kind of sad. And I liked it because I like those two characters and I want to see them happy. And I mean, I think that's a pretty common lament when you get to the middle of life. People are just like, what didn't I do? How could I have been happier? But we'll talk about it more when we get there. And chess. I'm a really big chess fan. And so I liked the chess theme of this episode in particular, but this part of the season. So anyway, let's get into recap. As we already talked about, the opening credits give us a sweeping scene of the tops of large chess pieces. And as Em mentioned, there's some superimpositions that are done by Diane Keaton that we really haven't made heads or tails out of. So, but anyway, next we see the Black Widow, Evelyn Marsh, and her accomplice talking to a police officer. She gives up the info pretty quickly about James. I mean, do you think? I don't know. She's always talking about how she cares so much about him, but then she's like, he's all, it's Jim, Jim. And she's like, James Hurley. I think he said he was from Twin Peaks.
Well, she's playing this all laconically, right? Which really didn't make sense to me until later. It seemed like it was more style over substance. I mean, you start with her hosiery, which is pretty badass looking, but her, I just wish, I hate to talk trash, man, but it just seems more style over substance. I wish there's a little bit more to buttress the visuals we're getting. Because I started to understand the character of Evelyn Marsh a little bit later, but I think maybe they needed more time and just a little bit more, something more from the actress.
Yeah, and I think there's parts in this episode where they're trying to elicit sympathy from the viewer in her direction. And it doesn't work because we haven't been able to generate any of that beforehand. We're not going to be able to do it right at the end.
No.
You know, so it's just a
They've
and the
never established a connection from us to her.
exactly, and it's
So,
definitely not here now when they're
yeah.
trying to do it. So this cop that's talking to Malcolm, and he's like, Jaguar, JAW. This is like this town's version of Andy.
I don't know what that is. I saw that. Then when he walks out, you got the two other cops that just fall in line like baby ducks or ducklings following a mom. And then later on, you have all the cops sitting at the bar. And then when that cop comes in, they're just all saying, "Hi, Frank." I don't know if this is Diane Keaton's view on the police force that she just thinks they're a bunch of automatons, and she wants to express that. But then this is about Twin Peaks that involves the sheriff's department pretty heavily, so that's kind of strange to bring that to the table. But maybe she's showing that this police force doesn't have what Sheriff Truman has and Cooper has, as far as their investigation qualities.
It could be. It could be. I mean,
Even though Sheriff Truman really relies on Hawk, which has been established
yeah.
by Daniel.
Who's not in this episode at all?
No.
But I mean, he's not in every episode anyway, but he's in the majority of them, I think. But
But there's like a little Hawk, like the guy who is they had the two that followed the other cop in this scene you're talking about, the guy that was last in line, he was like a little version of Hawk.
Could it be that there's some subtle commentary here on maybe the writer's part and Diane Keaton's part as well, that this is a bad subplot and these are like cardboard cutouts and it's just stock characters in the background? It just occurred to me. There may not be anything to that.
Why shoot yourself in the foot like that?
I don't know. I mean, you should follow through. So I hope that's
Definitely. I
not what
mean, the
they did.
actors certainly are. I mean, we know Richard Beamer was not happy, but he's still following through.
Well,
And
I'm
he
talking about
said,
this particular
I'm just
storyline.
talking about in general, like, no matter what you think about what you're doing, you should follow through.
Well, I agree that they should follow through. I'm just saying maybe with this scene, and that's why you have the stiffness with the cops, because it's she's just trying to say these are just background characters that don't really mean anything in a scene that doesn't really mean anything to the larger thing of Twin Peaks. And like I said, I just came up with this just now. This isn't something that I've been ruminating over for days, so it probably doesn't have the, biggest basis in logic, but
So she uses them as quirky window dressing, basically,
yeah.
these characters,
Yeah.
which would, I mean, it would function so much better if they were just acting like normal people.
Well, it draws your attention to them,
Yeah.
and then once your attention is there, if that doesn't go anywhere, then you've kind of dead-ended and you're just like, what? It pulls you right out of your suspension of disbelief for one, and then your attention is focused on a scene that's not, or on an element of a scene that's not actually producing anything to move the story forward. So it might look kind of cool, but after a second or third viewing, it becomes ridiculous.
It's just style of over substance once again. It's
Yeah.
weird for the sake of weird, and it doesn't play out. It doesn't follow through.
Okay, so at Hideout Wally's, a row of officers smoke cigars in the exact same positions and listen to a woman singing in Italian, like you've already mentioned. James and Donna walk right past them and wonder how they will get out of this mess. They discuss calling Ed as they are pestered by a waiter who's
Who knows Donna's name, Miss
somehow,
Hayward?
yeah, I guess she introduced herself at some off-screen point. And then he comes back around again and he's like, after they discuss a crucial point in their plans, and he's like, are you sure?
Well, he buries his nose in her hair practically and then says, "Are you sure?"
This is almost the theme of this episode, people burying their noses in other
Yeah.
people's hair. It comes up with Audrey and Bobby later on. So, Ed, or James has this kind of reaction about, like, he's talking to her about Donna. I mean, I'm sorry, he's talking to Donna about Evelyn, and he's saying, I know her. If I just go and talk to her, then everything will be okay. And Donna kind of gets this look on her face, and she's just like, why do you think you know her so well? Do you think she's figured it out at this point that,
If she has, that's it's small, it's an insignificant in, when it's set next to what the woman's doing to James. So she's
Yeah.
not letting that bother her.
Okay. I think that's when she began to suspect, but like you said, it's not
Yeah.
really, it's immaterial at this point. So the next scene we have Bobby and Shelley are questioned by Truman and Cooper at the station. They try to get more info out of Bobby about what happened, with, why he was at Shelley's house, and then Cooper asks him, where were you the night the mill burned down? And then there's kind of a back and forth, and the interesting thing about this scene to me is that Cooper seemed more interested in the chess set. that him and Wyndham Earl were playing on than anything else. And he doesn't even look at them when he talks to them for the most part. He's looking at the chess set and he's saying, "Well, you tried to shoot Leo Johnson." And he's like, "No, that wasn't me. That was Hank Jennings. You guys know all this stuff." It's almost like Cooper's going through the stuff that he already knows is true, that Bobby's already said to try to catch him in a lie. But yeah,
Probably.
Bobby is his usual sarcastic self in this
Bobby
scene.
at his best, though. I mean,
Yeah.
the actor does, Dana Ashbrook, it plays such a good punk, as Albert calls him, though.
He's almost wasted when he's doing something else besides being a snarky smartass.
Yeah.
You know, because the other scenes that he's been in, when he tries to do, when they try to have him do something else, just don't come out as good as that. Like, I'm not saying he's a bad actor otherwise. I'm just saying that that's when you're right,
Yeah.
he's at his best there.
Shelley was suffering very politely all of Bobby's
Oh yeah, well he's all going, I
behavior.
kind of glossed over that, but he's just like, "I'll protect you. We don't need the protection of these police officers."
Yeah.
And it's just like, "My husband just last night was about to kill you if I didn't stab him in the leg. Don't tell me you're going to protect me." You know, and you can see that this is a very different Shelley than the one that they ushered out of the office however many episodes earlier, when they were like, "Well, it looks like you've got it figured
But
out,
she's
you
all
know."
like, "What?"
Yeah, what are you talking about? And they just shut the door in her face. She's very thankful now. She's kind of been put in her place and chastised by life and the situations that it brought. So Albert is coming in as they are leaving and has the best line of the episode when he brushes past Bobby and says, "Get a life, punk." I laughed out loud. I forgot he did that, and when he said it, I laughed out loud. And Albert and Truman share what's probably my second favorite moment between them, when they have the big hug and everything, and I like it. My first one has to be the 2 blocks up on Queer Street. So Albert gets down to work. His reason for being there is Wyndham Earl. He details the package sent to various cities in the South and the Midwest with articles of Caroline's clothing. You notice that the cities form a C pattern?
Yeah, Cooper.
Or Caroline?
Yeah,
Or both?
both.
Yeah. So
It's dumb.
yeah. It's
It's
really, well,
dumb.
the thing that I don't get is, we were talking earlier about things being on the nose or not.
Yeah.
And this is super on the nose. It's a huge C in the
Yeah.
midsection going down to the south of the United States on a map. And Albert doesn't mention it. He doesn't even do his snarkiness and say, "You notice the C, Cooper?" or anything. It's there for us to see, but they don't make any commentary on it, which I think is kind of weird.
Any reason why being that part of the country? Why not in the Northwest? Or
Yeah.
did it have to be there?
You know, I think they were looking at major cities, and when you start to get out towards the Midwest
You
and
can't
the
make a
plains,
C.
you can't make a C with major cities. I don't think you could do it, or else it would be like a screwed up J or something. It
Yeah.
wouldn't, you know.
Her wedding shoes are ugly. I just want to point out.
Just put that out there from
Yeah.
a fashion sense,
They're
from a
just
purely fashion sense.
pure ugly.
So we get a little bit of interesting explanation of how rigor mortis works from head to toe, and then leaves from
Yeah, and I
toe to
think
head,
I've
or
always had that. I feel like I've always had that knowledge, and it must have came from Twin Peaks. Always remembered that. Yeah, I know you like Albert, and I mean, I don't mind him here, but I just feel like he's a different Albert. He's not the same Albert, but it's okay. It's okay with me.
he's toned down a little bit. I can give you that for sure.
He doesn't have that edge anymore, is what he's got a
Well,
duller sheen.
yeah, I was going to say that we're not dealing with dead people, but we are dealing with dead people, because Wyndham Earl killed Powell and set him up in the office to, point to the chess piece with his rigor mortis, which is part of that explanation. So I was going to say that Laura's death, was maybe, or Maddie's death too, was part of his edginess before, because he's trying to catch a killer. But, maybe to him, Wyndham Earl's a known commodity, so he's not as frantic. I don't know. I'm just throwing explanations out there, so I'll just get to the Albert comments about Cooper's uniform choice, and it's worth quoting at length. "Replacing the quiet elegance of the dark suit and tie with the casual indifference of these muted earth tones is a form of fashion suicide, but call me crazy, on you it works."
Didn't know Albert was a liar. But now we do.
At the very end of the episode, before he looks at the mask on the bed, he goes over to, Cooper does in his room, he goes over to his FBI suit and tie, and he's just kind of,
Yeah.
he feels it, and he's kind of wistfully, it's almost like, "I'm almost ready to get back in you." So
Hurry up, Cooper.
to me, though, I wrote down in my notes, I said, "This to me is commentary on the show as a whole, with Cooper really being the only thing that's worth watching any longer." He's kind of saying, "Call me crazy, but it works on you." So it's like saying
Yeah.
the everything's out of whack, and it would normally be crap, but because of you, it's working. So the next scene we've got is the very puckish form of Wyndham Earl playing his
Yeah.
flute in long johns. You know, I think that's what they're going for, the way he perches up there with both legs together. You know, it's almost like he's minimizing himself and trying to make himself look small while he plays the flute. And
Mischievous.
yeah, that's what it came, you know, Puck from
Yes.
Midsummer Night's. I know you know, I'm
Same
just
here.
saying it.
Yeah, it came to me too.
He's playing his flute in the dreaded long johns. I don't think any fans are
And they're dirty.
fond of the long johns. Yeah. After a shot of a spinning saw and some old gears, you know, right after that shot, it goes into this one. He wakes Leo and tells him that he knows about his rap sheet as he pulls it out of his long johns to read it to Leo. And then he proceeds to beat him with the bamboo flute. And then he fits him with a shock collar and feeds him gruel. Poor Leo is going to forget how to feed himself eventually. He's had everybody else in the whole, you know, series feed him except for himself. You see, you know, it's like Bobby does it, Shelley does it. Or now we've got Wyndham Earl feeding him. I guess the class of people that is feeding him just keeps getting a little higher, so maybe that's a good sign, his trajectory. What in the hell were they thinking putting him in long johns? Let's just address that now. Unless it's in listener feedback, and then we can address it then.
Maybe it's what he wears under all of his costumes.
What did you think of this scene in general?
I actually felt sorry for Leo, which is surprising.
But I agree with our listeners, though. You know, you can't take Wyndham Earl and make him. You can make him crazy, but if you make him crazy but not threatening anymore, it
He's
loses all of it. So,
too zany.
yeah, that's a good way to put it. He's just too zany. He's not. He ceases to be threatening. Now he's just like another crazy character.
Well, I think that's what Mary Moon was trying to say about Amy Bailey, who we interviewed from The Vikings. She plays a character named Princess Quenthrith, and her character, when you first meet her, she comes off crazy.
Yeah.
But she had to find that fine line, how to play that. You know, she didn't want to be too zany or
Right.
whatever, and she found that line. But that line got crossed, I think, here with Kenneth Walsh playing Wyndham Earl, which I think has to do with Diane Keaton's directing. But she's an actor, so she's gonna, you know, kind of have a free-for-all acting approach.
Interesting.
I
Well,
think it might have been Daniel's letter that
it
I read
didn't
that.
work. It didn't work. Let me just say that. So, Big Ed and Norma share a nice moment in the bed, lamenting the missing 20 years of their life together. I thought this scene was kind of bittersweet because I like both of those characters, and it's so sad to hear them talk about how they've just devoted their lives. They kind of put their heads down and went to work, you know, and they left behind their dreams, and now they're getting a chance to relive that. And they're saying, like, look, maybe the last 20 years that have gone past us are gone, and we can't touch them anymore, but we've got so much time ahead of us, and it's kind of cool. It's a positive message. Nadine interrupts by breaking the door down, literally, and getting into bed with them, where she proceeds to apologize to Norma for pounding Hank. Nadine is cool with their relationship because she's getting really serious with Mike. Really serious. This is a goofy scene after she comes into it, you know, but I think it's one of the iconic visuals that you get from Twin Peaks that I always remember is the three of them in bed together.
See, I'm probably going against the grain here. I didn't really care for Ed and Norma, but the scene improved when Nadine showed up
Really?
for me. Yes.
Oh, interesting.
And then also because I've seen this a couple of times, I was looking around at the decor, and it was just like child, female child, not very coordinated. And this was Nadine before she became teenage. In her mind, her decoration.
Yeah, she was an adult woman, and she had stuffed animals everywhere, and you know, these paintings on the wall of I don't know if they're supposed to be her or
That
what.
horrible wallpaper and the
Yeah.
clashing floral
Poor Ed, man, having to
I
put up with
know.
all that shit for all those years. I mean, it's just like, and the situation never gets better because
No.
I mean, she becomes and you know, she regresses, then she comes back right when he's getting his shit on track. It's like, oh God. So, Truman and Cooper confront Maid Josie about her connection with Jonathan. In a bit of foreshadowing, she's caressing the wood of the table. So I thought that was a nice touch. Sensing an intimate moment is coming up, Cooper excuses himself to get another cup of Joe, but cautiously sniffs the percolator first. This is a callback that I don't actually mind too much because it's not too. They don't go out of their way, you know, they're not playing a certain kind of music and everything to make it happen. They're just doing it.
You know what else it calls back to that I think is more appropriate is the first time I think he was suspicious of her.
Shenanigans. Oh, that's an excellent point. I didn't catch that.
Because you see on his face for a moment, during that conversation when she starts talking about her husband Andrew, and her eyes kind of shift over to the side, and he looks at her intently for a second.
He probably just thought it was best to get up and leave them alone because he's a freaking human lie detector and all she does is lie.
Yeah.
Nothing that is true comes out of her mouth, you know? So, Pete enters with a bundle of dry cleaning for Josie, and we get a cool scene with the swinging door. I like this.
I didn't.
You didn't? I just thought it made the scene interesting and it held your attention because you're like, it's making your brain spin. It's making it work on a different axis to me anyway.
That's I'm glad it does, because I found it was distracting and just kind of a dumb move.
I think they could have done the scene without it. Don't get me
Yeah.
wrong. Probably just as strongly without it, but for some reason, I don't know. I like the swinging door. She threw a lot of stuff against the wall this
She
episode
definitely does. A good way to put
to
it.
see what stuck.
Yeah.
And to me personally, this is one of the things that stuck. I
Yeah,
don't know
that's.
why. I don't know why.
I'm so glad that we started out with an intro of us talking about my overcriticalness tendency, even though I feel uncomfortable about airing it out. But I know I said also we're trying not to be negative, but I just, if you're gonna, I just can't agree that
We're
that.
not being negative. We're being
Okay,
honest. We're
okay.
fans of the show. We're reviewing the show on a podcast, and we're being honest about our feelings. So the things we like, we say we like. The things
Right.
we don't like, we say we don't like. I'm not bullshitting anybody and saying I like something when I don't. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it when I don't like something. So
Yes, I won't feel bad then.
yeah, don't feel bad. So yeah, I think I already said Pete enters with a bundle of dry cleaning for Josie. Okay, we get I already said that. Paprika and goulash. That was a funny story about how, he couldn't. He basically couldn't get his point across that he needed the dry cleaning, but this whole scene is really just a preamble to leave Cooper alone with Josie's clothes so he can get a sample of the fibers from the vicuna
And
coat
take one of her gloves,
and take one of her gloves. Okay,
which is very convenient.
yeah, it's very convenient that all that stuff. There's a lot of convenient things that go on in this episode, a lot of convenient coincidences that just kind of happen to happen.
Yeah.
More on that later. But the phone rings and Cooper uses this art. Okay, I've already said this part. So anyway, the phone rings. It's for Josie, and it's Thomas Eckhart, who is talking to her and saying that they should meet and delivering veiled
And he
threats.
says dreadful like two or three times. And I was like, because he was foreshadowing that he was going to be on Penny Dreadful.
25 years later. That's interesting.
Yep.
That is
Almost 25 years later. Yeah.
24 years later.
Yeah.
Okay. Catherine is on the other line listening, and I don't think he hears her because they make a point to show you that she puts her finger on the hang up button. I don't even remember what that's called anymore. It's been so long. I know it's called the receiver, but I guess you put the receiver down and then it hangs
In
up
the
the phone.
cradle?
The cradle. Yeah. But remember there would be little buttons?
I don't know if I ever knew the word for that.
Yeah, whatever. But it's archaic now. I mean,
Yeah.
everybody's got cell phones and shit. So but she hangs it up and she says, "Welcome to Twin Peaks, Mr. Eckhart," which I think is there to let us know that now he's playing in her backyard. So we cut to a scene where Eckhart speaks to his assistant and says she went running back to Catherine Martell. Then they start speaking in a foreign language, which the subtitles on Netflix tells us is Afrikaans or
Yes.
Afrikaans. I'm not sure how that's pronounced.
Afrikaans.
Afrikaans. I went to Wikipedia and did some research. I
Yay.
researched it, and Afrikaans is a West Germanic language spoken mostly in South Africa, but also in Namibia and to a lesser extent in Mozambique.
So is it the Dutch colonists who
It
brought it
is.
there?
It's an offshoot of certain Dutch dialects that were brought by the Dutch colonists that originally settled, quote unquote, South Africa. Interesting. See, we all learned something new tonight. We're not just shitting on Diane Keaton. We actually learned something new. Moving on. Ben Horn is on his horse, but still off his rocker, discussing with Dr. Jacoby what to do with the Yanks after their defeat in his mind's civil war. This was a particularly cool scene because Jerry and Audrey discuss the merits of having Ben be insane, and he kind of sees an opportunistic, plan here to say, okay, well, Jerry can start doing some of the stuff that Ben and Jerry usually do, and Audrey's like, no. I'm going to shut this down really quick. And I thought this was Audrey at her prime. Everybody talks about how good she was in the first season when she was doing all her stuff and everything, and it's true. But as far as, shining lights of her character in this season, I think we've got a great example of it right here.
Well, she's grown up.
And she lets him know she's of the age of majority now. So, Jerry agrees reluctantly and says, "What's happened to the man is a tragedy." All right. Audrey asks Dr. Jacoby to bring her dad back to the real world, not the office, And Bobby enters to play his part in the charade, which is apparently sniffing Audrey's head and off-tune musical accompaniment.
Yeah, when he and then he goes and tries to sit down and nuzzle in her hair again, and his inability to blow that horn, I think, is just exemplifies his inability to.
Close the deal with her.
Yep.
The Black Widow, Evelyn, drinks at an empty hideout Wally's. Donna approaches her to talk about James, and the two share a pretty horrible back and forth about what's worth living for in life. Hard to
It
watch.
is. It is.
The only thing that I gleaned from this scene is that when she was talking to Donna and she says, you know, she's basically trying to say people your age, they think that if they everything's just going to be rosy if they could get out of one little jam. I thought that was actually pretty insightful, and I don't know which writer came up with that or who's responsible for it, but it's the one thing that I could take out of this whole scene that doesn't make me want to throw up. And it's true. A lot of people, especially when they're younger, but a lot of people carry this into their adult lives as well. They think that if they could just get past this one little hurdle and this one little thing, that everything's going to be great.
Well, this is where I think they're trying to make Evelyn interesting, and it's not happening. I mean, it was interesting how she straddled that stool and sat
It's
down,
very unladylike.
which I think it's just that's a sign, okay, she's drunk, but I think she's supposed to be a nihilist. If we had a connection with her, it would be more interesting.
She's not the greatest actress in the world, and she's not playing the greatest part in the world. That's a recipe for just some bad TV, you know, when we get right down to it.
Well, I felt like starting with this scene, I started to realize where they were trying to go with her.
Yeah. I mean, you usually don't hear me be out and out negative about scenes, but this scene I just really had a problem with because I felt like it was forced. And I felt like, yeah, they're trying to add a complexity to her character by making her somewhat of a nihilist, like you said, and it just fell flat to me. So I'm not going to sit here and beat a dead horse, but Malcolm shows up and manhandles the both of them, letting Donna know that if he sees her again, he will kill her.
Yeah, Donna still has the balls to yell at them when they leave after he does that. Which I think possibly if it was Diane Keaton's call to have her do that, but I think it was purposely meant to remind you of season one, Donna, when she yells like that at some point. So, I almost feel like Diane Keaton jotted down all her favorite moments with each of these actors and was like, okay, I'm gonna make sure I get them to somehow reprise that particular moment.
No, I could see somebody doing that. Anyway, moving on, we get what I believe is another good scene with Cooper and Albert. And like I said, I already said that these were the highlights to me. But Albert drops the info on Cooper that the vicuna threads he found are a match for the shooter, and that someone matching Josie's description is wanted for the murder of Jonathan Kumagai. Yeah, thankfully Albert has enough respect not to call him the murdered Asian man. Already covered that. His best quote here was, "Our sheriff's got a serious problem with his girlfriend."
Yep.
He does.
He does.
I thought it was nice how Cooper was like, "Look, we pretty much just have to keep this to ourselves until we know for sure, because it's already hard enough for Harry." But
Yeah. I mean, Harry obviously suspects because that's why he's saying, you know, now's the right time to tell the
do you have
Anything to
anything
say
else?
about this scene? I'm going to be critical again. Well, the only thing is just like to have Cooper come and stand in front of the actual projector to have it like, because you know it's light that going into your eyes when you stand in front of that like
Right.
that. Why would you do that other than to have this visual thing, have this interesting image where he's got a ruler over his face?
Well, he had the number 30
Yeah,
on his
number 30
face.
specifically.
And I'm wondering if he was maybe 30 years old this year or something, or it was around his birthday. I don't know.
And that matters because.
It doesn't, but it would be the kind of artsy fartsy inside joke that
Yeah.
somebody who was trying to be, you know, pretentious about their filmmaking would do. That's all.
Why, if somebody in real life went and did that while I was talking to them, I would think they were like a drama queen or something.
Or trying to be funny, you know,
In a time of real seriousness.
yeah, okay, yeah, you're right. It would just be stupid.
It would.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. All right, so Cooper visits Truman while he's playing darts, and once again doing anything other than actual police work, even with everything that's going on around him, all the crimes that need to be solved, everything that's going on with Josie, he's playing darts.
He's letting off steam.
Okay, I can buy it on the Twin Peaks taxpayer's dime. And he gets filled in about the vagrant's last name being Powell, Cooper does, from Truman. which is also Caroline's maiden name. Quite a few coincidences here. So his last name is Powell, Caroline's maiden name is Powell, and the vagrant happens to look almost exactly like Cooper. How likely would it be that he
Oh,
would
that
be
he
able
would
to
have that
find?
last name and also look like Cooper.
Right. It's astronomical.
I see what you're saying. So maybe that's why they didn't push the idea that he looks so much like Cooper.
Yeah, they let it be a visual thing rather than something that was remarked upon by the cast. Yeah, that's a good point. They discuss the importance of the pieces taken from the board on the chessboard, that someone will die each time, and Harry recommends a chess expert right here in town when Cooper admits that he's never won a game, so lots of people are probably going to die. So we go to my favorite scene of this episode, which is Pete at the Double R Diner playing three chess players at once. And it's Toad, Cooper, and Doc Hayward. And he checkmates them all in the same move, which is, I really like this scene because I'm a huge chess fan and it was just chess on screen. But there's some unrealisticness going on here. And the first one is that you would be able to checkmate all three people on the same move.
Yeah.
It's probably just, it's not going to happen because every
It would be
game
a
is
staggered thing because the games would be going at
different
different rates.
paces. Yeah. And each game is so different. You wouldn't, you know, and each level of play is so different. But anyway, I mean I'm splitting hairs here, but later on in the same scene there's stuff that doesn't really happen at all. But anyway, Cooper enlists his aid to stalemate a game of great import. And for those of you who don't know, to stalemate a game is not to checkmate the other player, but to get them in a position where, or have them get you in a position either way to where you can't move any pieces without putting them
In check.
in jeopardy or of being taken. So the game becomes a stalemate. So no one really wins, but a stalemate's, you know, not necessarily a loss either. And Coop says he's hoping to lose as few pieces as possible, which is somewhat feasible, and none if it can be managed. It can't. It can't. When you start off if you start off a game like that and your idea is to stalemate somebody, so many pieces can be taken in the mid game that if each piece represented a person, even if, you know, Pete was able to, through Cooper, to stalemate Windham Earl at some point, like 15 people would still die, you know, almost minimum. You know, it's crazy. But anyway, as they thump a chess piece to the board, Shelley walks across the red and white chessboard of the Double R to talk to Norma about getting her job back, which they polish an ice cream cone and talk about this amongst themselves. And it's a nice scene, I think, because, you know, she always told her, this is like your home. If you ever want to come back, then you can come back.
Man, be negative again. How she helps to wipe the ice cream. It's just really tedious movement that nobody would do in real life. It's just like James earlier in the bar with the umbrella. It was just there. I was distracted by him
Right.
messing around with that. It's just like I was distracted by them with the ice cream.
There's been so many scenes in this show where two people are just talking to each other and not doing anything else but talking, maybe holding a cup of coffee or a cigarette or something like that. Why now do we have to have something going on with their hands? Why can't we just have a cut of their faces and them talking to each other, kind of like you did with Ed and Norma in the bed? Which to me was effective. I know you didn't particularly care for that portion of that scene, but to me it was very effective just going back and forth between their faces. And they could have done the same thing here, just shown them from the shoulder up, but instead they had to, maybe it was symbolic, and she was going, "See, I'm helping already."
Maybe. There you go.
I'm cleaning up this ice cream cone that's obviously not dirty.
See, I really, really want to work here.
Yeah. Truman interrupts to talk to Norma about Hank. They go behind another door. So we get another one of these scenes where somebody's behind the door and talking, and they're framed in the little tiny glass pane, and they're talking very, very close to each other. They're inside each other's bubble. If you were watching this without sound and didn't know the story, you would think that this was like a romantic scene.
It was all for the framed shot.
Yeah, basically. But the gist of this scene is that Norma wants Hank gone forever, and Truman is going to do what he can to make that happen. So Mr. Eckhart arrives at the Martell house, and the verbal sparring between him and Catherine proceeds at a pretty brisk pace. They go back and forth and do their repartee and everything. They treat Josie like crap throughout this whole scene, just running her around, having her, you know, pour their wine, get their hors d'oeuvres and stuff. And they discuss a little Price is Right for the handing over of Josie as if she was not there at all. And then they call for the main course, and
Which is a pig
apparently
head.
it's a pig head. And I don't know if there's supposed to be some sort of dramatic import of it being plopped onto the table, but the music and the shot of that would tell us that that's the case. But this is one of those instances where I can't really glean anything of importance out of that.
It'd be better if it was a goose. Be like, Josie, your goose is roasted.
Yeah, your goose is cooked.
That's it. Your goose is cooked.
Our favorite scenes. Evelyn blows smoke rings and drinks booze. But this is maybe this adds to the complexity of Evelyn's character, because if she was truly a nihilist, she wouldn't care, right?
She's pretending at nihilism. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, you're right. She's pretending at nihilism. James barges in and demands to know why she did it. He forces her to tell him why she would do what she did, and she gives it to him with both barrels. So we find James in the clutches of a blonde femme fatale, once again, who recognizes his honesty, but is only honest enough to let him know she can't give him what he deserves because he is good and she is bad. Sound familiar? Malcolm thwacks James on the head and starts to paint her a picture that they will give to the police about he came in, he broke in the house, blah, 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 blah.
The way James barged in was kind of weird and silly.
They could have done it better, though. I mean, he opens this almost like a sliding door, and before he even sets foot in there, he's like, "Why did you do it?" Because, I mean, I could envision a better way of James entering. You know, he bangs on the door really loudly. She gets up, opens the door, and then, you know, right away he just starts giving it to her. "Why did you do it?" You know, instead, he's saying it almost as he's opening this door.
And it
So,
comes off kind of clumsy.
yeah, it does. It seems like ham-fisted is the term that comes to mind.
So anyway.
So, okay, now we have a scene where Audrey and Jerry now play their parts in the Ben Horn Civil War. The Appomattox scenario is playing itself out. Pretty silly stuff. Nobody can play their parts right except for Ben, which is why they all play along. Ben Horn and his sanity is the key to all their success, apparently. If you notice, everybody's bumping into everything and knocking shit down and saying that the line's wrong and stumbling over each other except for Ben. But he's the one who's fucked in the head, so it's kind of like a reversal. Ben's charade is finished as Jacoby, playing General Grant, surrenders the North. Ben collapses, and when he comes to, he has his Dorothy moment. I had such a strange dream, and you were there, and you were there, and you were there.
That's cute.
I'm just glad it's over. I'm glad it's over,
me
you know.
too.
I always liked Ben Horn. I felt like he was a,
He always brings his A game.
yeah, always. Even to this kind of just utter craziness, to where it's like Mad Hatter's own in the Twin, even in the Twin Peaks world. And he brings his A game, and he's just, I mean, Richard Beamer is an excellent actor. I mean, him and Ray Wise could carry the show otherwise. You know what I mean? He just throws in some Cooper scenes and just have like the three of them revolve, and they'd be fine, and have maybe a little bit of Pete Martell off to the side, and everything would be great. But unfortunately, we don't have Ray Wise anymore. But I'm just glad that this particular storyline is over. I mean, we still get some weirdness out of Ben Horn going forward, because he stops with the cigars and he starts with the vegetables.
The
He's the
carrots,
carrots and
and
the
celery.
celery and everything like that, and he tries to turn over a new leaf and stuff. But at least it's not Civil War Ben that's done with. All right, Wyndham Earle, in the first of his many disguises, coerces Leo to write a note in between shocks, of course, that has pictures. Well, the note doesn't have pictures, but it's on top. The note is on top of a piece of paper that has pictures of Donna, Shelley, and Audrey at the top.
Which look a lot like headshots for starlets.
And it looks like they were from season one, too. If you look, well, at least
Well,
Audrey's
what I'm trying
was.
to say, realistically, wouldn't they be like high school photos? I mean,
Oh yeah, okay, I get what you're saying. Yeah, they do look like their head like that. That's what you'd get for an acting studio or something like that, or
yes,
a
they look, they're not, especially in the
an agent.
90s. You don't have photos like that of yourself. Like these days, people do because everybody cares about Facebook and Instagram and stuff like that. But
Right.
back then, no. Uh-uh.
Yeah, I mean, unless they were like glamour shots. Remember those at the mall?
Yeah, but it wasn't like
I know, I'm kidding. Well, you're absolutely right.
that.
I'm just saying, I was
Most
being
people
silly
had
with
their
that.
pictures taken by a tree or something, or laying on the ground barefoot.
Wyndham muses, "Which one shall be my queen?" So we have the queen callback, finally, from the beginning of the episode. So Malcolm is trying to convince Evelyn to shoot James and to seal their plan and tie up the loose end. Donna watches from outside. Donna storms in and pleads with the pair to spare James. Evelyn does the first good thing we have seen her do and ends up shooting Malcolm. She rehearses what she will say to the cops by way of explanation while she's lying on him, making sure that he can't get up and he's kind of bleeding out from the gunshot wound. Now, did you notice that when they were tussling,
The dance macabre.
the dance macabre, if you will, you could hear it was, but you could hear Bob.
Well, that distortion that they do with the voices,
Yeah, that's exactly what it reminded me of.
So again, she watched season one and was like, "How can I reprise some great
Yeah,
moments?"
I mean they basically stole that sound effect and just put it into this scene, you know, because I know they're not trying to tell us that Bob was inside of Malcolm. That's just not gonna
Well,
fly.
they're trying to say maybe Bob is just like the expression of all evil and violence that happens in or around Twin Peaks, maybe.
All right, I can buy that, but Cooper whistles as he walks the halls of the Great Northern, waiting for the elevator. He pulls out a picture of Caroline. Wyndham, in disguise, walks right by Cooper. Cooper does not sense him at all. Thanks, Daniel. He delivers an envelope to addressed to Mrs. Horn to one of the attendants there, and then he picks up a free postcard with owls on it and just walks away. Apparently, it's free now. And if you look at the postcard rack, it's just all the same owl over and over and over and over again.
That's what happens when Ben Horn
Is
is
not
off
in
his
charge,
rocker.
yeah.
Nobody diversifies the postcard rack.
So now we're getting an association with Wyndham Earle and the owl. Do you think there's any water to be held with this?
No, I don't.
No. Cooper enters his room and finds a truly creepy mask lying on his bed with Wyndham's own version of Diane beneath it. And it starts to talk about Caroline in Pittsburgh. He lets Dale know that it's his move. He uses his first name, and I think that's the first time we've heard him addressed by just his first name and not Dale Cooper or Coop or Cooper. It's just Dale. And we are left with a vision of Cooper staring through the eye holes of the mask, looking like a villain. Is this how Wyndham Earle sees him?
Looking like a villain.
Yeah, because if you the closing scene is him, he's looking at the mask, but the mask is like facing our direction, but it gives you like a negative. So you see his eyes, but black around them. So it looks like he's wearing a mask, like a
Oh,
black mask with just his eyes
I
sticking out. And
see.
I'm just wondering if, because it's an inversion, maybe that's the way that Wyndham Earle sees him, because he blames him for the death of his wife, even though he killed her.
That's an interesting perspective. I didn't see it like that, but I think that's interesting. You saw it like he's wearing that sort of like ski mask is what you're
Yeah,
describing.
that's how it looks.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes it look like Cooper has a ski mask on. But the camera shot is from the inside of that mask looking at Cooper's eyes, so it gives a
Which, I mean, this episode has been kind of playing with that, where you've got looking through the eyes of the mask at Cooper, you've got looking through the door at Norma and Harry, you've got the only one I actually liked, when Audrey looks through her little binocular or unocular at Ben Horn while he's on his horse. There was a lot of those shots where you're looking through something else at another person. Style over substance. Once again. But yeah, it sounds like you're making a connection with this, and I like that, so that makes it better. You could also look that you're looking through the eyes of Carolyn's death mask too, and in a way that could criminalize Cooper or just incriminate him because indirectly he was responsible for her death, you could say. I did, even though it was inexplicable, I did like how the eyes were lit up.
Yeah, there's no explanation for why they weren't, because it was super creepy when you see it sitting on the bed like that. And then when he lifts it up, you hear the click of the tape recorder, or the tape player rather, going off, but you don't see anything that would have illuminated the eyes. All right, well, that's the end of the episode. That was the final scene. Any other thoughts before we get to recap, or before we get to
Feedback?
feedback?
No.
All right, let's go right into it then.
So our first letter is from Joel. He says, "Stephen M., you've been mentioning that Twin Peaks has been acting like a pastiche of itself lately. If that's been true for the storylines, now it's really true for the style as well. It's as if someone told Diane Keaton, 'Hey, go shoot something weird. This is Twin Peaks after all,' and this is what resulted. Sometimes I can't stand watching this episode, and at others it seems like a relief after the more bland previous ones because, hey, at least there's something interesting to look at. But for the most part, all the visual conceits, the superimpositions of Evelyn Marsh, The guys in uniform all turning their heads at the same time, the giant chess pieces feel kind of empty and artificial to me. They certainly don't have the effect that Lynch's work does. That said, there's a very nice, crisp quality to the lighting and color in this episode. Keaton was apparently an accomplished photographer as well as an actress, and that certainly comes through. In the feedback section for the previous episode, you made an interesting point about Lynch's heroes often being flawed. Just look to another Kyle MacLachlan character, Jeffrey in Blue Velvet. Although he's clearly the hero and has a very evil opponent to face, Jeffrey has a dark side as well, most notable in his troubled relationship with Dorothy, even as he is also seeing the wholesome Sandy and the ambiguity of his voyeurism. Is he simply trying to solve a mystery, or is there something kinkier at work? And Frank even says to him, "You're like me," and the deleted scenes of Blue Velvet made Jeffrey seem even sketchier. Yeah, when I was editing, I was mad that I hadn't mentioned Jeffrey, and then when I read this from Joel, I was like, "Ah, yes." That's the more obvious connection there about our last discussion of feedback. So Joel goes on, "So maybe you are right, and if Laura's mystery hadn't been solved so soon and Lynch had stayed involved with Twin Peaks longer, Cooper too would have had his dark side exposed. I wonder what form this would have taken. It's interesting to consider. The book The Passion of David Lynch has had a big impact on how I see Lynch and Frost's relationship to Cooper. The author, Martha Nochimson, I'll try that. Martha Nochimson spoke to both creators and came away with the impression that the Cooper of the show's second half was very much Frost's version and that Lynch had greater sway in the first half. But because we don't know what could have been, it's hard to gauge how Cooper would have developed in other circumstances. I also think Lynch's fondness for flawed heroes characterizes his later films more than his early ones. Jeffrey in Blue Velvet, Sailor Ripley in Wild at Heart, and Dr. Treves in The Elephant Man are uncertain about themselves, but ultimately their good side triumphs and the purely evil bad guys distract us somewhat from their inner struggle. But in later films like Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, and Inland Empire, the evil is more abstract and metaphysical, and the heroes themselves are sometimes revealed to be the villains. Even the straight stories, Alvin is facing his own demons rather than the evil outsiders. It's worth noting that for Lynch, the transition point between these two types of storytelling is in fact Twin Peaks. I wonder if the direction that Leland Bob, Cooper, and Laura all took, in which good and evil end up deeply intertwined, changed how he dealt with these issues. Here's an interesting question from an interview with Lynch and Rolling Stone in 1990. Question. What I'm wondering is whether, outside the films, you see the world as having these very strong dichotomies between good and evil as opposed to a kind of complex, integrated a answer. No, I know it's complex. Everybody's got many threads of both running through them, but I think in a film, white gets a little whiter and black gets a little blacker for the sake of the story. That's part of the beauty of it, that contrast, that power of it. Maybe it would be very beautiful to have a character that had an equal mixture of both, where the forces were fighting equally. What's so interesting is that this was published a few weeks before he shot the big reveal exposing Leland as possessed by Bob. So for the first time, really, Lynch was forced to openly depict the idea of a character who had an equal mixture of both, where the forces were fighting equally. After that, the very next time Lynch returns to the show, it is to depict Cooper's struggle for his soul in the Black Lodge, confronting his own shadow. And then when he shows as Laura in Fire Walk With Me, this is how she is too. So it's interesting to read that quote and realize that as he said that, Lynch was on the cusp of changing his view and embracing the possibility of mixing the black and white. Anyway, that's a long ramble, but it's such a fascinating subject. Thanks for your feedback on the feedback, which I really feel helps the keep the conversation going and keeps me on my toes as well. I hope other listeners will join in if they have thoughts on this or some of the other big picture issues too. Next up, Josie and the Drawer Pool. Joel.
Well, to address the first part of Joel's letter, I would say that I'm trying to imagine if Diane Keaton walked into this and played it straight, you know, if she had just made a Twin Peaks episode that she felt was artsy enough to stay true to whatever it is that could be considered the general Twin Peaks aesthetic, but didn't try to go overboard, say like the scene in Wally's hideout with the cops all turning, you know, and saying, "Hi, Frank," and you know, weird stuff like that. That just kind of felt like out of place, and probably would have felt out of place even in the first season of the show. It doesn't feel right. It feels, I don't know how to categorize it or what box to put it in and file it away, but it rubbed me the wrong way. And I felt like there was a good amount. I tried to look for the bright lights in this episode, the things that were better, that rose above the morass, I guess. And like I said, I liked Albert, I liked the chess scenes, and I liked Ed and Norma, but that was really about it. The rest of this episode wasn't necessarily throwaway, but it didn't do a whole lot to drive the story forward. Most of that revolved around Cooper and a little bit around Windham Earl. But I'm getting off track of what I'm trying to say. But basically, I'm trying to envision in my mind how this episode could have been different if Diane Keaton had played it straight and just kind of did what the people right before her had done and just said, okay, I'm just going to make a Twin Peaks episode instead of saying, I'm going to make a grandiose, great Twin Peaks episode that has
Right.
all of these different things in it. And I don't know. We're never going to see that episode. We're never going to know. That's lost to history. But this is what we got stuck with, and this is what we have to comment on. So
What was the superimposition of Evelyn Marsh that he mentions?
it's when she has, I think he's referring to when she has her widow's veil on, and
Oh.
her face just kind of keeps coming out at certain
Yes.
scenes.
Yeah. Okay, I remember that now. Okay. And that, I think, was to show her conflict. It was during the time where she was having her moment of
Doubt.
doubt. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to see that her moment of doubt had actually started
At the
at the very
beginning.
beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like some of the ideas he's bringing up about the nature of good and evil within any given character, about how it's nobody has completely black or completely white running through them. Everybody is some sort of shade of gray that meets in the middle. And people have a little bit more of one or the other. And then how, when it gets to the depiction of that on the big screen, you make the whites whiter and the blacks darker. And you kind of go with that because the clash between the two then it gets to be more epic. It gets to be
Yeah,
more
it
of something
does.
that you want to watch. That's why when you have like a sci-fi or fantasy or adventure movie, you have these villains that are just ultra bad, and you have these heroes that are ultra good. So when you can see them clash at the end of it, kind of like when you're watching The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings or something like that, you have very purely evil characters and very purely good characters, which is very different from, something like a Blade Runner or something like that, where everything's a little bit ambiguous because you don't even know the true nature of any one of the characters at any given time. Are they this or are they that? I don't want to spoil Blade Runner if no one's seen it, so I won't say what they could or couldn't be, but I think you guys get the point.
So, I know there's been a lot of talk about how the network force at least Lynch's hand
Right.
in revealing the killer. And so, I mean, Joel, are you putting forth the idea that even though this was considered a burden that was placed upon Lynch to show his hand as far as Leland was concerned, that it ended up being a boon because it shows up in his later work? He's expressing it now out of choice in movies like Mulholland Drive, where these characters have inner demons they're dealing with. That's what it sounds like.
That's a really good way to look at it. I mean, your hand was forced to a certain extent, so you decided another route of storytelling, something that you wouldn't have done if your initial vision had been seen through to the end. You would not have done that. But you did it because of these circumstances, and then it breaks you open into this new world of thought to where you're like, wow, let's explore this. Let's see what this is about.
Okay, so anything else you want to say? Looking forward to Josie and the Drawer Pull.
A little bit, just so she can get off the show. Yeah.
Okay, so we've got two letters from Daniel, and Daniel says, "Hey, Stephen M. At last, the Ben Horn Civil War and Evelyn Marsh plot threads finally come to an end. But so much of this episode feels like the equivalent of a hyperactive kid waving its arm, saying, 'Look at me,' to get attention." I agree.
Definitely. Yeah. It's too all over the place with all this, with all the artistic stuff.
It captures that cool sense Lynch's work has, whereby bizarre things and effects are happening, and it makes you wonder what it means. But unlike Lynch, Keaton's over-the-top, self-indulgent direction choices are wasted on shallow, inconsequential plot points that have no deeper meaning. Well put. Not to mention way too many overlays, especially that awful repeated shot at Evelyn in her Evelyn in her mourning veil. So here's what I think happened, and sorry in advance if this feedback comes off more like a rant. It's okay. I've already ranted. Diane Keaton is primarily an actor and with very few directing credits to her name. I don't dislike her by any means. I loved her in Reds with Warren Beatty. Like many of us, she fell in love with Twin Peaks back when it was really good and was probably excited to get the chance to direct an episode. On the one hand, Peyton turned in a weak, lackluster script like any other day at the office, but Keaton was determined to turn it into a work of art and so pulled out every possible thing she could from her filmmaking bag of tricks to gussy it up and make it look interesting, even if the content left a lot to be desired. On the other hand, I think a few of the scenes on paper actually could have been really effective in the hands of a more experienced director, but Keaton's amateurish insistence on taking them way too far made them fall flat. I see plenty of examples. An officer who can't spell Jaguar is hiding two more cops behind him just out of the camera's view, so we get a wacky gag where they all stomp out in unison. Or the row of identically dressed, cigar-smoking officers at Hideout Wally's, all facing the same way and listening to some bizarre opera music until they all turn together to say, "Hi, Frank." Like, what is going on here? There's that overlay long gag where Cooper and Pete talk over Josie's dry cleaning while the door inexplicably continues to swing open wildly, and Keaton has Cooper and Pete stand just so their heads are perfectly blocked in the door cutouts. Harry and Norma have to stand practically kissing just so they can film through that tiny window at the diner. While talking to Albert, who is right beside him, Cooper walks away in the middle of the conversation to stand in front of the projector and address him, just so we get the number 30 projected on his face. By the way, any numerological significance there for the character, do you think? Well.
No, absolutely none. That's a dead horse, and we're not going to revive it.
That fucking shaking cam effect used for Malcolm's death scene, complete with distorted demonic voices that sound like the same technique used for Bob during Maddie's murder. This was one of those infuriatingly disrespectful, misguided choices that, when I first saw the series, made me puzzle whether or not something supernatural was supposed to be going on with the whole Marsh storyline. Hint, it wasn't. Whittemerle, written as a mysterious and dangerous mastermind, is portrayed as a zany supervillain prancing around in his long johns, playing the flute, or twirling his fake mustache in an atrocious suit. This character, who is supposed to be menacing, feels like he has no teeth at all. In an interview with the fanzine, Wrapped in Plastic, number 20, actor Kenneth Welsh summed up everything I think is wrong with how Diane Keaton directed him. Then we had Diane, and she, of course, being an actor herself, was totally free with having us put our own input into it. She would encourage us to go even further. I remember when I was doing that scene with Leo on the floor, she would just say, "Go, take it as far as you want." She was having as much fun as anybody because it was a new exploration for her, too. She hadn't directed much up until that point. She was like a kid enjoying all the toys she had, and she had us go along with it. Like that whole shakuhachi flute business, Diane made full use of it. She knows totally how to bring the actor out, to let the actor go, invent, and explore, because she did all that Woody Allen stuff. Then Daniel says, "I think directors are supposed to direct actors by toning them down to appropriate levels and not just let them go wild and overact when it doesn't fit the scene or the subject matter."
That,
Daniel's.
yeah, that's absolutely right. You're ruining it. You're ruining it. This is supposed to be a Twin Peaks episode. It's not your playground. You know, you're there to, you're a hired gun to do a job, and you're supposed to keep going in that chain, you know, and when you don't do that, you're disrespecting the job.
And then you just ruin the character, Whittemerle, on top of it.
Exactly. I mean, and that's lasting damage. That's not just one bad episode that people have to watch because they can't, it's a soap opera, so they can't miss it. They can't just skip that episode because significant things do happen. But, you know, it's just disrespectful at the end of the day, you know.
Daniel goes on to say, "Do you think it was intentionally erotic the way Shelley and Norma are both on their knees polishing that giant ice cream cone?" I don't think it's erotic, but it's funny that you think so, Daniel.
I have to admit that I did not see that scene that way. That did not enter my mind, and you know, now that you mention it, I still don't see it that way. But I mean, it's just a.
I see it as tedious, and it was just like the scene with, like I've already said, with James with the little like umbrella, drink umbrella.
It's a visual distraction
Yeah.
that's unnecessary because it diverts your attention away from, like, she was very focused on accoutrements in this episode, like little things to go with the scene that didn't really matter.
And they were very unnatural focus on it. Like,
Like you mentioned the ice cream scene right after that, Truman and Norma are talking, and like I said during the recap, they look like they're about to start kissing. If you watched it without
which he
sound,
mentions in here
yeah,
too.
if you watched it without sound, it would look they're in there each other's personal bubble, and it was all done, like you said, and like Daniel mentions as well, to get inside that little, it looks like an 8x10 frame. And it's just you're squeezing the story to fit into your visual format, and that's a huge no-no.
Story should be
Story
supreme.
should yeah, it should be king. It should that should dictate everything else. You have the story, and then you build the visual around that. And I understand that Lynch has said many times, or at least a few times in interviews, I won't say many times, I won't exaggerate too much here, but he said that a lot of times that he's built things as far as what we see on the screen from a vision that he's had. So he's taken the art and he's built the story around that at certain times. But if you're not David Lynch, don't do it. That's the lesson here,
Daniel says, if you watch carefully when Josie opens the door for Eckhart, you can see he was literally standing there with his back facing towards the door, presumably just so he could turn around dramatically.
It was this. We didn't mention this in the recap either, but this struck me as like a scene out of a Hammer horror film, with the sound effects and the lighting and everything. Like he was just revealed to be Dracula,
You just
and
needed
he's
the
like,
dramatic
ah.
music for with it.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, there already was some kind of dramatic music. Well, was it music or was it the sound effects? Maybe it was just the sound effects. I think it was like wind and, a peal of thunder or something like that.
Daniel goes on to say, all of the postcards on display at the hotel are of owls. Subtle, Keaton. Real subtle.
Oh, yeah.
Then he says, how much creepier would it have been if the death mask had been left in Cooper's bed before we were ever shown Earl? I really do like that shot, and especially that mysterious light glowing underneath it. That is, until they do camera gymnastics just so Cooper's eyes are perfectly blocked behind the holes of the mask because art, I guess. I like your interpretation of it.
Yeah, I stick by my interpretation of it. I think that that's how Wyndham Earle sees Dale Cooper.
I do think the intention was what Daniel's describing for art, but I prefer your interpretation.
He brings up a good point. If we had seen that mask before we saw Wyndham Earle, he would have been a lot creepier, but his fall would have been that much more worse. So I'm glad they did it the other way around. I'm glad they did it this way because now it adds an element. They make him creepy, then they make him goofy with the long johns. Now we edge a little bit back into the creepiness element of it with the mask. If we had seen the mask before and we had seen, okay, well, I'll say this. If we had seen the mask before we saw him, it would have heightened our sense of how creepy he could be as a character. Then we see him in long johns right after
Well,
that.
we might not have seen him in long johns right after that, because if somebody else was directing, like if she had done the mask and that was in another episode, maybe it wouldn't have been
Yeah.
treated as such. Maybe he would have had
So at the end of the day, if we just get rid of the long johns, we're good.
and the puckishness.
Yeah. Well, the puckishness could actually fit in certain scenarios.
Not in a character who's supposed to be super smart, super stealthy, but they've already fucked up with the vagrant anyway.
Yeah.
We talked about that last episode. Yeah, he's.
It's a bad idea for that character. No character that would be that actually that smart, that intelligent, that cunning, and that uncatchable would be able to pull something off like that without leaving any evidence behind. It's just not humanly possible.
And now we got the letter C on a map that he created by mailing parts of wedding dress and shoes and everything. It's
For
just.
no other purpose than to, like, they're fake
Than to
mail
taunt.
bombs.
Yeah.
To really, all that came out to was so we could see a C on that map, and then it never gets talked about. So it's just kind of like,
Which, he. It's almost like his plan didn't work because he had to be the one to tape the map underneath the table so Cooper could find out about it. Because even though they traced all these mail bombs to these specific sheriff's departments or whatever. He still had to be like, look what I did.
Yeah. He was just too goddamn smart for everybody else, and he had to show them how clever he was.
Yeah.
It's like a joke that goes over everybody's head, so you have to stop and explain it to them. And then they still don't get it, so you have to write it down on a map.
See what I did?
Yeah.
That's another callback to the
Oh yeah.
Cooper.
And when he's talking about the owls and the postcard thing, and
Yeah.
he's like real subtle. I mean, that scene could have been played subtly, really easily. All they would have had to have done is play the same exact scene, but he goes over and there's the postcard rack, and each one of the postcards is different, and one of them's an owl. And he grabs that particular one and says, "Oh, an owl." And he walks away with it. That actually would have worked really well. But what they were all owls. So it's just like you're just getting smacked on the head with it,
Or
and you
even if
pick
he
that one.
doesn't, if it's one of the ones facing, the camera and it's an owl, but he just picks one up pointedly but doesn't say anything, it would be something you would catch on rewatch.
But it was not subtle in any way, shape, or
No.
form.
So he says, sorry for all the negativity, but those are the kinds of things that really stand out to me in this one. But I definitely find it more fascinating to watch than some of the more other straightforward, weak episodes we've had. Did you two feel the same way about this episode and its bizarre direction, or am I being too harsh? I tried not to be harsh, but I feel like I came off as overly harsh throughout this recap. So I'm sure your question has been answered at this point, Daniel, from my point of view. But Steve, go ahead.
I don't think you're being too harsh. No, I don't think either of you guys are being too harsh, or anybody who wrote in. I don't think Joel's being too harsh. I don't think you are. I don't think Daniel is. I was striving and endeavoring to try to find the best elements out of this episode that I could, which I've already said what they were, and kind of pull them up and shine a spotlight on them to highlight some positivity. But having said that, even though this had some visually quirky stuff, I actually liked the last episode a lot better because it made me laugh. There was nothing funny in this episode. I mean, there's a few like snarky little, kind of half smiles that you get out of what Cooper's or what Albert is saying to Cooper, rather. But there's nothing that was a laugh out loud moment, really. And I mean, I get maybe like one little thing here or there, but like last episode, I laughed out loud several times. So I had a good time watching that episode. With this one, I felt like I was struggling through it.
Yeah, I feel like I was scrutinizing it.
But I feel like the weirdness and the quirkiness of Twin Peaks needs to be balanced with a little bit of darkness and a little bit of humor. And I feel like this was all one thing and not enough of other things.
All right, so Daniel writes us back again and he says, hey, Stephen M., I realized in my first feedback I focused mostly on the production, but I also had some thoughts on the story this week, too, that I'd like to bring up in the discussion if it's all right. I've noticed every time Bobby has a breakthrough scene and genuinely seems like he's going to straighten up, it's not long before his behavior just sinks down to an even lower layer of slime. After literally almost taking an axe for Shelley for the second time, this episode he's back to acting like a giant insufferable douchebag. It's also really weird to keep in your mind that he shot a guy dead in Fire Walk With Me just before this series. Even in the pilot, James says Laura had said something about Bobby killing a guy, but it really doesn't seem to affect how he's written. That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, but we get, I don't know, I was going to say we get a lot of that because you get these characters that they're trying to reform over time that you don't like at first, and then, you slowly get to like them for one reason or another, but then they disappear or they die or whatever happens to them. But I don't know, with Bobby, it feels like he was a bit player at first, and then he was Laura's boyfriend, but he wasn't the main boyfriend because that was James, and then it just got like, he got bigger and bigger and bigger as far as his role in the show, and then it just drops off the face of a cliff. So we're finding a place to put him. It feels like the writers are finding a place to put him, and they're trying to accentuate certain elements of his personality, but not other elements of his personality. They just want to sweep him under the carpet because this guy did kill somebody. I mean, that's pretty serious. I mean, but when you look at the portrayal of how that happened in Fire Walk With Me, it's not like he was just this complete cold-blooded murderer, wasn't it? I mean, wasn't he pretty like, holy shit, what the hell did I just
Yeah,
do?
he was upset about it, and I think it's actually too bad that they didn't run with that. Like maybe his story would be more interesting if they forced him, because I think that was part of the problem, Dr. Jacoby was trying to get to the bottom of when he was confronting Bobby when Bobby was there with his parents. But Bobby couldn't really talk about it, so he
Yeah.
was kind of using his dad as a way to talk about himself as a killer, but accusing his dad of killing. But if they had carried that through even up until now, where Bobby's still trying to deal with it in some other way because he can't be open about it, of course it would get tired after a while. You couldn't carry it for too long, but
Yeah, there'd have to be a resolution at some point.
they definitely could have carried it longer, than they did. And even if they did have a resolution, it would still define his character in some way. And it does seem like it's just completely, been. I think they've lost sight of it. They've forgotten.
Well, I get the general impression that James mentions it to Laura in the pilot, and it's very in this like offhand way, or Laura mentions it to James. I guess that's how it went, right? Because
Yeah, but
Laura.
James is telling, who is he telling?
Is he telling Donna?
I think so.
But whoever he's telling, he mentions it to them, and then it never gets mentioned again in the main series. You know, and there's allusions to it with what Dr. Jacoby's doing and stuff like that. But it's almost as if they had this little kernel of an idea, and then they go through all of season one and then all of season two, and then they finally decide to do something with that because they're like, hey, we're in prequel territory. Remember that time we said that Bobby killed somebody? Let's go ahead and play that out. How's this going to work? So I always get the impression that from that, or I'm getting the impression now at any rate, that they didn't really have a concrete idea. It's not, I don't feel like the idea of what he did or the concept of what he did in Fire Walk With Me was definitely cemented in everybody's minds while they were writing all this.
Probably not to the degree that it ended up playing out in the movie, but I think they had an outline. I think they had an outline. How was Laura like interwoven into everybody's lives, and how when she that ripcord is pulled, how is this going to affect everybody? And I think you probably had an outline that, yeah, Bobby and Laura were together, and she got him, dealing drugs for her so she can get him, and then as a result, he's corrupted. What could happen to Bobby? Oh, maybe he killed somebody for her or because of her. Okay, that's the outline. That's all they know as they're going in. You've got all these other outlines for various characters in relation to Laura. So that's how I imagine that was probably worked out, and
That
then it got
sounds,
fleshed out in Fire Walk With Me. And so they were only able to kind of touch on it a little bit,
So
in season
keeping,
one, but they left it behind.
so let's say that that's true. Let's just go with that. If that's how they were approaching it, they're not looking at Bobby. They have it in mind that he did this thing because of Laura, directly because of her actions, but they haven't fleshed it out yet. They haven't given it any kind of concrete reality and described exactly what happened and when and how. So they're not viewing him as a killer when they're writing him. You know what I mean? They know that he killed somebody, but he's not viewed as a killer. He's not a Hank Jennings. He's not a whoever else killed somebody on the show. He's not fitting in with that ilk. He's something. He's a different animal altogether. So,
Or they've forgotten.
or they've forgotten. Yeah, it just got lost in the shuffle. Because honestly, as much as I've seen, Fire Walk With Me in the first season, I don't think about that a lot until I get to the point where I hear James say it in the pilot. It's not always in the forefront of my mind when I'm watching his character on screen that this guy killed someone. You know, I just think of the dumb things that he's saying and the shitty way that he's treating people and the selfish stuff that he does.
Okay, so Daniel says, I've said before how ever since Albert's strange speech out of the blue to Truman, I felt like the writers have been softening his character, and I kind of miss his insulting, sharp-witted cynicism. I understand they can't have him and Harry coming to blows every time they are on screen together, but it just doesn't feel the same character, and it bugs me. Here, he missed a perfect opportunity to make fun of Harry for misunderstanding how rigor mortis works, and he also thinks Cooper looks good in plaid. He is wrong, Steve.
I'm standing on my own little island in in the credits when they show the river going by, to the waterfall. I'm just standing out there on a rock holding a flannel shirt. It looks good.
Not with that hair. So, Windham Earl has been sending fake bombs containing Caroline's wedding apparel to major cities in the southern U.S. Why are we even wasting time on this when it is so far away from everything else that matters in the show? The cities form a C. I didn't get this the first time I watched, but C for Caroline, I guess. Also, Cooper has an immediate emotional reaction to Caroline's wedding dress, but if you think about it, how awkward would it be for the woman he was having an affair with behind her husband's back to be showing Cooper her old wedding garments? I thought the same thing. Like, it's not like it was the wedding dress she wore to their wedding. It's her and
Shit,
Wyndham's.
I didn't even think of that. Why would he even have seen that ever? Unless he, we don't
Or
know.
just a reminder of his own guilt for sleeping with a married woman would be the only thing I could
But
think
he
of.
recognizes it as her wedding dress. He recognizes all these articles of clothing. And so it's just like, at what point would it have been appropriate for her to just be like, hey, Wyndham's not here. I'm going to pull this wedding dress out of the closet and show you. I got married in this dress.
He probably went to their wedding. Wyndham was his partner.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean,
But a guy's not gonna remember a wedding dress. Seriously.
if I had went to Paul's wedding, and I would not remember his wife's wedding dress. It just,
Unless it was super slutty.
even then, I wouldn't be able to just like, if it was just sitting somewhere, be like, hey, that's Paul's wife's wedding dress right there,
So Daniel says, "See, in Ed and Nadine's nightmarish bedroom of stuffed animals and flower wallpaper makes me feel even worse for poor Ed living under Nadine all these years." We had this conversation.
Yeah, poor guy. God damn. We come to a lot of the same conclusions.
Yeah.
So it's great to do it because it seems like whatever we miss, you know, it's like a completion thing, you know what I mean? Whatever we tend to miss, our listeners write in and fill in the blanks, and then sometimes we bring up stuff that they didn't think about in a certain way, and you know, they'll write in later and say it. So it works both ways. It's kind of cool. But a lot of times we hit the same notes because I think it's hard not to with certain things, especially if you're in tune with the world of Twin Peaks and you're just kind of like, or if you're just, you know, an avid TV watcher and you're paying attention to what's going on screen.
Daniel goes on to say, "Cooper suddenly taking a sample from Josie's wardrobe seems so random and contrived at this point. What might have worked better is for Pete to accidentally drop them, and when Cooper goes to help pick them up, show a flashback to Cooper shooting just like Lynch used for Bobby remembering Hank shooting Leo in season 2 premiere, triggering Cooper's memory that this looks like the same coat and gloves his assassin wore." Yeah, that would have been better.
A lot of things would have been better. I mean, the only thing I liked about that scene, really, when you get down to it, is the swinging door, which everybody else seems to dislike. So I'm in the minority about one little thing. So I mean, nobody really feels like anything was great about this scene, except for him sniffing the percolator to make sure there was no fish in it. That was good.
See, if they didn't waste time on the swinging door, they could have developed this scene as Daniel described. So Daniel goes on to say, "Is it weird how Audrey spent all of her time acting out and basically ruining her father's life, and then even saw him for the repulsive sleaze he is when he tried to have sex with her, but now genuinely seems to want him well and back in her life, unlike Jerry, who is surprisingly eager to double-cross his beloved brother this week?" I did think it was interesting that when Audrey was pretending to be that Southern belle and introduced herself, like her dad playing General Lee had kind of like flirted with her a little bit. And so it reminded me of the One-Eyed Jack scene. But this was, you know,
A lot more
she was more
tame.
of a willing participant and definitely a lot more tame, but.
I mean, to be charitable, we could just kind of look at it as she cares about her dad underneath it all because she's a decent and solid person, you know, and she's the type of person who might care about a family member even after they've done wrong to her, which is a very rare trait for somebody to have, but it still exists,
After
you know.
all, she still has compassion for her father.
Yeah, that's the short version. That's the Cliff Notes version of it.
So Daniel says, "I really want to see the scene where bikers try to beat up Bobby in that outfit and give him an atomic wedgie."
Man, I'm meant to mention this at least two different times. I should have just wrote it in my goddamn notes. When he comes in and he says, "See, bikers tried to take it from me." Unless these were bicyclers, they would have taken it from him. Bobby's not kicking anybody's ass. Come on.
Daniel says, "My theory is that those bikers who tried to steal his jacket were Scotty and Joey Paulson from the pilot, getting revenge for Mike and Bobby starting that bar brawl at the Roadhouse." Then Daniel says, "I like to see what adventures Hawk is out having to make the world a better place while Truman plays darts in his office."
Yep, see, great minds influence other minds because Daniel brought that to our attention, you
Yes.
know, about how Hawk is really the one who's holding together the Twin Peaks PD, and Truman, the sheriff, is just kicking back, you know, watching birds, playing darts, you know. So whenever I mention that, it's because Daniel brought it to my attention for all you listeners who maybe just, you know, started listening in the last few episodes or something.
Daniel says, "Going back to what I said before about how uncomfortable Josie's predicament feels from a human rights standpoint, the show is clearly treating her like a literal slave. Thomas and Catherine talk about her like a piece of property while discussing selling her back to him, and it's gross." Yeah, it is gross, and it's, I don't know, just dumb. I've said dumb, I don't know how many times.
It's it you really get the feeling that it's coming to a head, you know, because it's like how much further could they take this without her dying or something happening or her disappearing for good, which kind of both happened at the same time, I suppose. But it just got taken to an extreme, you know, and then when you've got Catherine Martell and Eckhart sitting there at the table and just, you know, discussing a little Price is Right. That's an Amanda Palmer reference, by the way. Anyway, yeah, it's gross. I mean, just watching her in the maid uniform and everything, it has this feeling of absurdness. So it really doesn't hit me on the level of like being really shitty from a human rights perspective. It's a good point to bring up. I don't disagree with the point, but I don't even see it like that. I just see it as just like, oh, Jesus Christ, we're doing this again. Let's just get to a conclusion for this.
What do you think the whole point of like her fingernails? I mean, they focus on those a couple of times. Are we supposed to like glean from that she still has her claws? Like she's not defeated yet?
I don't know. That sounds as good as anything else.
So Daniel says there are some genuinely laugh out loud moments during the Appomattox scenario, though. Highlights included the stuffed horse that actually neighs when Ben pats it. Audrey as Scarlett O'Hara is just perfect. Bobby's awful trumpets playing, and the enormous Confederate flag falling down on top of Dr. Jacoby. As strange as it is to have any of that in the same show as Maddie's murder, for example, I feel like the whole thing is pretty hilarious.
See, I felt like it was funny, but not laugh out loud funny, because as I commented earlier, I think when we were reading the feedback from Joel's letter, this episode, I think that's when I said, but anyway, what I'm getting at is that this episode had some funny bits in it, but it didn't make me laugh. It'd just be like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, that's goofy or that's silly or whatever. But last episode, I was laughing my ass off several different times. So it's just a contrast in the way it was presented, I guess. I guess the Appomattox stuff is just, it's almost like the Josie scenes. You're just waiting for it to get to its climax and be done with because you're ready to move on to the next phase. It's like, this is, you've done what you came here to do. Now get off the stage.
Well, the neighing of the horse caught my attention because that's something that caused me to think about the actual editing process and sound editing process, because that's obviously artificial neighing that's placed in there. It's not like a recorded device that's
That's
playing
in the horse,
that's in the
yeah.
horse itself or anything like that. So and because I was scrutinizing this so heavily, I was just like, why did they do that? Did they do that because it's funny? Did they do that because the scene needed improvement? So let's do this. Make it more slapsticky. But yeah,
It feels like it was added just to heighten the element of absurdity that was already present, but that was not necessary. I mean, we have a guy who's a business tycoon in this small town who owns half of it, and he's going mad in his own office playing a Civil War general who from the South who wins.
would have been better if they just had a real horse in there and Audrey's trying not to step on horse poop.
You see, that actually would have generated some laugh out loud moments, you know.
With her awesome boots that she was wearing. And Daniel says, all right, that's all for real this time. Sorry about that. Thanks, and I hope you two have a great week as always. Daniel. Yeah, thank you, Daniel. You have a
Thanks,
great week
Daniel.
too.
Thanks for writing in. Hopefully we'll have more to say. I feel like this has probably been the episode that we're the most negative on so far. And I know we're not alone in this. So, I know some other podcasts have gotten some criticisms before for being too negative about this era of the show. And I hope we're not falling into that category. I'm trying really hard to veer away from it and look at the positives and everything. But there's a lot to criticize in this episode, though, that can't be denied. I mean, it's tough love is what it is. It's tough love, you know.
I apologize for my negativity. If I could turn it off, I would.
You don't need to apologize for it. It's there as a reaction to what's being shown to you. You're not striving to be negative, you know. It's just a natural reaction to what you're seeing.
All right, so Tyler, and he says, first you didn't twist my arm. I appreciated the shout out 2 episodes ago. Cool. And he says, next, the log lady intro talks about death masks and wanting to examine the dead body of a loved one rather than abandon it. It's really spooky the way Catherine Coulson delivers the lines, and it's worth watching. She's got this great twinkle in her eye. The officer is an even worse actor than Evelyn's. Why do they leave in a group of three? What's up with the guys in a group of five at the bar? I don't know.
Yeah, we've kind of covered this ground already. Like crisscrossed it back and forth, actually. I think we've just come to the conclusion that this is the artistic license excesses of this particular director.
Yeah. He says, is the interview with Bobby supposed to be reminiscent of the pilot? His bad boy act with the lighter is a little bit canceled out by his hat,
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't really think about that. That's a goofy fucking hat, and you can't pull off that, like, I'm in the laugh in the face of authority, and but I didn't think about the callback to the pilot. That's a good point, because they're in the
Yeah,
same
I didn't
room,
either.
you know, all they're missing is a television.
And that's how he was acting then. But Cooper handled him well, but Cooper was kind of only halfway involved in this conversation. He was aware enough to ask about the shooting of Leo, but
Yeah,
as you
'cause
pointed out, he was looking at the chessboard most of the time,
Truman
right?
had to be the one to tell him to button it.
Button it.
You know, he probably logged some overtime for that. You know, he was like, you know, I did some actual police work today, so I'm just gonna write that I worked for 10 hours instead of 8. He's just, you know, padding his paycheck.
Yep. Hawk's shaking his head.
Yeah, just
Still waiting on that raise. Okay. Tyler goes on to say, I like that Albert yells his quote from Cole. Yeah, that's what I did like about Albert, is that he imitated Gordon Cole and he did it well. And then Tyler says, I always forget Albert appears in this episode because so much craziness is going on. I was relieved to see him.
Yeah, when he comes on the scene and he's like, get a life, punk. That's not laugh out loud funny. Once again, I didn't think a lot in this episode was laugh out loud funny, but that was great. That just made me feel good.
Tyler says, Wyndham and the flute. At least he's playing Questions in a World of Blue. His speech about the samurai is just so out of left field. Also, that girl looks like baby food. Yeah, baby food 2.0 for Leo.
He just can't, ugh, he can't escape it.
Yeah, and I guess the Questions in a World of Blue is,
The song he was playing?
and it's reprised again when Evelyn Marsh is blowing smoke rings.
Hmm.
Saxophones are playing it. Okay. He says, I actually like this Norma and Ed scene, but I always like their scenes. So he agrees with you.
Thank you.
And he says, I can just picture Norma outside his house unable to deliver that bolo tie. Do you think it was intentional that Norma's wedding ring is visible towards the end? Probably.
Yeah, most definitely. I couldn't tell you exactly why, but I think that there was probably some intent with that, or why would it be in this, you know, in the scene? Maybe just to give you, because the scene where she talks about Hank with Truman is later on in the episode, so possibly because of that.
It's a reminder, even though we don't really need to be reminded, but well, anyway. So Tyler goes on to say, in the Josie scene, there's coffee and they're focusing in on her plot-wise. More proof for my theory. The dry cleaning bit seems like a poke at how many fur coats there were in the Packard household in season one.
When she was walking around all the time with the fur coats, talking
Well,
about.
I remember, I think the first time we see Catherine is when both Catherine and Josie walk out of the house to, you know, because Laura's body had washed up, and I think they were both in fur
Oh,
at that
okay.
time too. Yeah, they were wearing a lot of fur in that house. They're a bunch of trappers.
Well, Josie and Catherine aren't trappers. They're schemers and plotters. Pete might be a trapper, but.
What was his coffee theory again?
That Josie had put it in there, I think. This is going way back, so.
No, didn't he write in saying, about talking about your cigarette theory, what about so many people drinking coffee?
Oh, the coffee theory. Okay, I
Yeah.
thought you were talking about the percolator and the fish and stuff like that. No,
No.
I believe what Tyler was saying about the coffee theory is in if people can be seen lighting cigarettes up about to do something, you know, crazy or whatever. People who are drinking coffee are actually focusing in on a problem and using their intellect. They're about to solve a problem. They're about to do something smart and beneficial, in other
Okay,
words.
so Cooper is having coffee at this point, and that's where he focuses on the fur coat.
And it's right. It's exactly what he
Yeah.
does. So he gets the vicuna threads in the glove, and he pretty much figures out who tried to put a cap in him.
Tyler says, I love that Audrey is smarter than Jerry now. First Bobby, now Jerry. I would love her to be mayor of Twin Peaks in season three. Yeah, I think she would be better mayor definitely than Truman, because I had suggested maybe Truman would be mayor.
Yeah, I'd like to see Audrey as mayor more.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. She's like the new Catherine Martell of town.
But you know, she's hasn't been corrupted yet. Hopefully not ever.
Well, it's been 25 years,
Yeah.
so who knows?
So Tyler says, Evelyn is being a mean weirdo again because she's bitter. Donna misses another chance to slap her right in the face. Yeah.
Weirdo.
That
That's being very charitable.
made us crack up though when we read that last time.
It's like, Tyler, it sounds like you're trying to be nice but angry at the same time. You know, like instead of just calling her, hey, this is a stupid bitch, or like, you know, something along those lines. It's like, you're being a mean weirdo. Don't make me say this again in a louder voice because I will.
Tyler goes on to say that Pete, as a chess expert, is the greatest relief in this episode. He can make the most ridiculous scene seem earnest.
When he says Jose Raul Capablanca, for some reason I always remembered that. It's like one of the only things of this period of season two that always sticks out in my mind. And,
For some reason, I remember Toad being a chess expert, but I was way off. Don't know why I thought that. Yeah, I mean, Jack Nance is great, and everything. Even if he's lugging around dry cleaning and he's having to say ridiculous lines while doing it, he still manages to do it.
He wasn't used to his greatest effect in this episode. I mean, I wish the writers and Keaton had like a better grasp of what the fans feel, which is, and I mean, this is all in hindsight anyway, but anytime you add Jack Nance's rendering of Pete Martell into a scene, it makes it more Lynchian, it makes it more Twin Peaksian, it makes it better. So anything that has to do with Twin Peaks can use more Jack Nance. Unless it's a scene at the Black Lodge, and he might be a little bit out of place there.
Tyler says, I love Norma and Shelley's friendship. The scene was deserving of Laura's theme. The double R really wasn't the same without Shelley. Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah, I totally agree. I'm glad she's back. I'm glad they kind of brought that full circle. You know, she said she could come back. This is like her family to her. It'll be like you never left. And Norma, you know, she kept good on her promise.
And Shelley's not the same without the double R or Norma, too.
Yep.
So the Tyler says the Eckhart scene is shot like a James Bond movie. It's just so terrible, very heavy-handed.
Agreed. Yeah. I think Daniel had said that it looked like he was turned around completely with his back to the door, and then when he, you know, just so he could turn around and have this, like,
Da da
yeah,
da.
exactly. And like I had mentioned, it's a step away from a Hammer film. It's just like it's, you know, the director spent the greater part of this episode trying to be as artsy as she could be, you know, and then you get to something like this. And it's almost juvenile.
Yeah.
You know, you're almost like, what? You just hit the reverse on the car and just start going backwards with it. What the hell are you thinking?
And then Tyler says, another Wizard of Oz reference with the strangest dream line by Ben. I know Lynch loves that movie, but apparently so do the other writers. And he says, that's all I've got. Saving Pine Weasels, Tyler.
Saving Pine Weasels. The only thing that I could really add to this that I haven't said already in the recap or in addressing somebody else's feedback is that after he does wake up and he has his Dorothy moment, like I said, and he said, I had the dream and you were there, et cetera, everybody laughs and cheers eventually, you know, when they figure out that Ben Horn is back. And I almost feel like I don't want to give credit to anybody who had anything to do with this episode necessarily, but to me, what I'm reading into that is that these guys were just as happy as the viewers that were done with this particular
I felt
storyline.
like that from Russ Hamblin for sure.
Yeah.
I got like anytime he was just like, yay, all right. Like he had this look of like, let's end this scene.
Yeah, let's get this done. Come on. He always has that look at his like the that shifty-eyed look where he's like looking at the exits all the time and he's ready for the next thing or he's like, you know, going, all right, if I need to get out of here in a hurry. But he really looked like that this episode. Like, let's move it on. Let's wrap it up. Let's get Ben Horn back to reality so we can all get on with our regular acting jobs here and stop this Civil War reenactment crap.
Thanks, Tyler, for writing in.
Yes, thank you very much.
It was fun to read your letters. It's fun to read everybody's letters.
Yeah, I like everybody has a different style,
Yeah.
you know. It's just like Tyler's reminds me kind of like one of our Vikings listeners,
Bib.
Bib, who does like the almost like a mini recap,
Like a stream of
a
conscious
stream of
recap.
consciousness, like a gut reaction to each scene,
Yeah.
you know, and then maybe ending it with a question. And then I guess you can characterize Daniels as kind of like almost like a more it's almost like he's taking certain points out of it and just like when you go on the computer and you make something larger. You know, and just saying, all right, look at this scene. Now think about it in a bigger way. What about this, 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 and this? And it
Yeah.
really makes you think. And then you got Joel, he's like
He's the academic.
he's a Nobel laureate essayist. You know what I mean? And I always feel bad because we seem to have the least to say after we read Joel's feedback. But I think it's because it's hard to follow that. It's hard to come back after reading what he just said
Yeah.
and add anything of substance to that. It's like it's an entity unto itself.
Every
You
time I
know,
read his stuff, I get educated. I really can't
I mean, I feel like I make an attempt, you
Yeah,
know, to
I
say,
do
okay,
too.
well, my two cents on what Joel is saying is blah blah blah. But really, when you take what he says and you just read it, it almost just stands alone, and it's done. But anyway,
Yeah, and thanks for still writing us in despite those facts, Joel, like that you're still, finding it interesting to write
Yes,
to
I think what
us.
Em's trying to say is that we're glad you feel that we're worthy of these letters. So,
Yeah.
I really like the it's like this with Vikings as well, and I really like the way that each of our individual listeners who do take the time to write us in have a different and unique style,
Their own particular
and
voice. Yeah.
that's a good way to put it. And then they bring something to the table, so it becomes this discussion between a bunch of people, because, like I've said before, I know I'm Steve the Broken Record, but we need it at this point in time.
All right, so anything else you want to say, Steve?
No, I'm just hoping that I don't remember exactly the content or the form of next episode. I'm just kind of keeping my fingers crossed that at least we'll get some good laughs out of it, and we're getting closer to the good parts of season two. So every episode brings us a little bit closer to the whole Black Lodge stuff.
Yeah, what, 7 episodes left, something like that?
I think there's 7 episodes left total. So we probably have, even if the next 4 episodes are just complete bunk, I mean, that's all we have is 4 episodes. And then we get into the last three, which are all good. So
All right, well, that's all I have to say.
that's all I have.
All right. I'm your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.